A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We've talked about Euroboxes on this show before, but today, Daniel's asking us to zoom way out. Here's what he wrote. He starts with the industrial plastic containers we've discussed. Euroboxes, Dolovs, pallet boxes, IBCs, the whole family of heavy-duty HDPE storage. His point is that, if your only reference is the bins at Home Depot or IKEA, you're missing the category entirely. These things are built to stay in service for decades, designed to be repaired and reused. He finds them genuinely transformative for anyone who moves frequently, rents, or just values well-designed systems. Then he raises the tension. He was talking with Hannah about how you'd sell these to consumers, maybe even start a business, and the obvious pitch is environmental. But that hits a wall immediately. It's hard to call any plastic product environmentally friendly. So he backed up and asked, if we decide plastic is the wrong material for storing household goods, business inventory, industrial components, raw materials, what replaces it? He runs through the candidates. Wood works for a few domestic applications, but can't handle the full set of demands. Stainless steel has to be mined, refined, transported. Aluminum is enormously energy intensive to produce, even if it's recyclable. Timber is renewable only with sustainable forestry and doesn't suit every application. Every material has a footprint. Every material involves trade-offs. And that leads to the real question. There's broad agreement that single-use plastics, packaging, bags, cutlery, should be reduced as much as possible. But is that where the objective ends? Or is the long-term goal a world with dramatically less plastic, even no plastic at all? Because if that's the destination, what replaces it becomes unavoidable. Within the storage world, stainless steel Euroboxes and steel pallets exist. They're excellent. They're also vastly more expensive. You can't tell a small business on tight margins to replace an entire warehouse with metal alternatives that cost 20 times as much and have to be imported. So he lands here. Maybe the real debate isn't plastic good or bad. Maybe it's about identifying the applications where plastic is the best available material and distinguishing those from the applications where we've become dependent on plastic simply because it's cheap and convenient. What's the actual end state? Is sustainable use of plastic possible if products are designed to last decades, repaired when damaged, kept in circulation almost indefinitely? Or is that merely a transitional stage before plastics are replaced altogether? And if replacement is the goal, what materials realistically take over? So that's the landscape. Let's start with what actually makes these industrial containers different. Because if you haven't held one, the gap is hard to describe.
The gap is physical. Consumer-grade bins, the Sterilite tubs, the IKEA SAMLA boxes, are typically polypropylene or lower-density polyethylene. Wall thickness is maybe 1 to 2 millimeters. They're designed for light static loads in climate-controlled rooms. An industrial Eurobox is rotomolded or injection-molded HDPE with wall thicknesses 3 to 5 times greater, metal-reinforced stacking lugs, and load ratings of 300 to 600 kilograms per the EN 8040 standard.
300 to 600 kilograms.
Per container. Stacked on a pallet, you're talking tons. And the design philosophy is completely different. A consumer bin has a lid that snaps on and eventually cracks at the hinge. A Eurobox has replaceable lids, replaceable corner protectors, standardized pallet-based interfaces that fit perfectly on an 800 by 1200 mm EUR pallet. When something breaks, you swap the part. The container stays in circulation.
So it's the difference between a tool and a temporary suggestion.
That's about right. The reusable packaging literature is clear on this. Each reuse cycle dramatically reduces per-use environmental impact, but only if the container actually stays in circulation. A Eurobox can survive 30 to 40 years in service because it was never designed to be thrown away. It was designed to be maintained.
Which brings us to the material paradox. The same properties that make HDPE ideal for a 40-year container, chemical resistance, UV stability, impact toughness, are exactly what makes single-use HDPE problematic. The material isn't the issue. The use pattern is.
And that's the thread we're going to pull through this whole conversation. Daniel's sales pitch thought experiment, the material comparisons, the end state question. It all turns on whether we're talking about plastic the material or plastic the behavior.
So let's start with the thought experiment. Daniel's imagining selling Euroboxes directly to consumers. Who's actually buying?
I see three segments. First, frequent movers and renters. If you're in a new apartment every 2 or 3 years, a standardized modular system that fits any truck or van and stacks perfectly is a genuine quality of life upgrade. You're not buying bins that fit this closet in this apartment. You're buying a system that moves with you.
Just a second.
Hobbyists and small businesses. People with inventory that needs to survive damp garages, basements, outdoor storage. Think someone running a small online retail operation out of their basement, or a mechanic with parts storage in an unheated garage. Consumer bins warp and crack under those conditions. A Eurobox doesn't care.
And the third segment is probably the most natural fit. People who already buy things for life. Cast iron pans, leather boots that get resold, wool blankets. They're already paying a premium for durability. A $40 container that outlasts them isn't a hard sell if they're already thinking in decades.
The problem is, you can't lead with, this is eco-friendly. Plastic is plastic in the public imagination, and you'll lose credibility before you finish the sentence. The pitch has to be about waste prevention. This one container replaces dozens of broken consumer bins over its lifetime. You frame it around durability and cost per decade, and let the environmental benefit be the quiet implication.
Which is where the life cycle assessment framework gets useful. The functional unit in an LCA isn't one container. It's storage capacity over 40 years.
Right. And under that metric, a Eurobox outperforms cardboard, wood, and even some metal alternatives on carbon per liter year of storage. HDPE production emits about 1.9 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of material. Stainless steel is 8.9. Primary aluminum is 16.5. The upfront carbon cost of metal is enormous.
So the metal container has to stay in service vastly longer just to break even on carbon. And that's before you factor in the weight penalty for shipping.
A stainless steel Eurobox weighs 3 to 5 times what an HDPE one weighs. Every time it moves on a truck, it costs more fuel. Over 40 years of logistics, that adds up. There's an LCA comparison that puts a stainless steel Eurobox at roughly 120 kilograms of CO2 per unit versus 6 kilograms for HDPE. Even with multiple reuses, the steel box doesn't break even on carbon unless it's used for more than 100 years.
100 uses. Optimistic for anything that's being handled daily in a warehouse.
It's unrealistic for most applications. So the reflexive, replace plastic with metal, instinct doesn't survive contact with the data. The material that looks virtuous at first glance often carries a heavier environmental burden when you actually run the numbers.
Let's put some concrete numbers on the consumer side. A single Eurobox costs somewhere between $25 and $60 retail. A Sterilite bin from Home Depot is $5 to $15. The payback period is 3 to 5 replacements, which for most households is 10 to 15 years.
And that's the hard part. Most consumers don't think in 15-year payback periods for a storage bin. They see the sticker price and walk away. So the business model has to change the framing.
This is where Daniel's business idea gets interesting. He's not necessarily selling containers. He could be selling storage as a service.
Container as a service. It already exists in industrial logistics. CHEP operates something like 300 million pallets globally, each reused 20-plus times with a repair rate of about 5% per cycle. Europool system does the same for reusable crates in fresh produce logistics. You don't buy the pallet. You pay per use, return it, it gets inspected and repaired, and it goes back into circulation.
The pallet pool model applied to consumer storage. You pay a monthly fee for a set of Euroboxes. They arrive at your door. You use them for as long as you need, and when one gets damaged, you send it back for repair or replacement. The company owns the containers and has every incentive to keep them in circulation.
That's the alignment that makes the whole thing work. If the manufacturer sells you a container and walks away, their incentive is to make it cheap enough that you'll buy another one when it breaks. If they retain ownership and you pay for availability, their incentive is to make it last as long as possible with minimal repair cost. The business model and the environmental outcome point in the same direction.
Nobody's adapted this for consumers yet. The infrastructure doesn't exist.
But the economics are interesting. If a household needs, say, 20 Euroboxes for their storage needs, that's maybe $800 retail. A subscription at $20 a month breaks even after 40 months, just over 3 years, and includes free repair and replacement. For someone who moves every few years, that's competitive with buying new consumer bins each time.
There's another angle. Daniel's prompt hints at that. We haven't touched. The standardization advantage.
Oh, this is the part I love. Euroboxes conform to EN 840 and ISO 3394. They stack perfectly on standard EUR pallets, 800 by 1200 millimeters. They fit in standard truck beds, standard cargo vans, and they interface with automated warehouse systems. For a consumer, that means your storage system is compatible with moving trucks. You don't have to Tetris a bunch of mismatched bins into a U-Haul. Everything stacks, everything interlocks, everything fits.
That interoperability is a feature no consumer bin offers. You buy a random assortment of tubs and totes over the years, and you end up with a jigsaw puzzle every time you move. A standardized system eliminates that entirely.
And it's not just moving. If you ever need to put things in storage, standard pallet-based dimensions mean your containers stack on warehouse shelving. If you run a small business that grows into using a third-party logistics provider, your storage system is already compatible with their racks and automated systems. The standardization is a form of future-proofing.
So we've established that the sales pitch exists, but it requires a different way of thinking about cost. That brings us to the bigger question. What are we actually trying to achieve? Is the goal a world with less plastic, or no plastic at all?
The pollution data points pretty clearly in one direction. A 2021 study in Science found that 60% of plastic pollution comes from packaging and single-use items. Durable plastics, construction materials, transportation components, industrial storage, account for a tiny fraction of leakage into the environment. The stuff that ends up in oceans and rivers is overwhelmingly single-use.
So the target should be use phase optimization, not material elimination. The problem isn't HDPE. The problem is HDPE designed to be used once and discarded.
And the policy landscape reflects this. The EU's Single-Use Plastics Directive targets 10 specific single-use items. Cotton bud sticks, cutlery, plates, straws, stirrers, balloon sticks, food containers, cups, cigarette filters, and oxo-degradable plastic bags. It explicitly exempts durable plastic goods. Regulators are already drawing the line between problematic and acceptable plastic uses. The distinction exists in law.
Which means Daniel's framing is exactly right. The question isn't plastic or no plastic, it's short-life plastic or long-life plastic.
And the long-life plastic infrastructure is underdeveloped. That's the real gap. We have a global system optimized for producing cheap, disposable plastic goods, and almost no system for keeping durable plastic goods in circulation.
If the goal is a world with dramatically less plastic, we have to ask what replaces it. And that's where the material trade-offs get really interesting.
Let's run through them systematically. Stainless steel. Excellent durability, fully recyclable, but 20 times the cost, 3 to 5 times the weight, and energy-intensive production. Aluminum. Lightweight and highly recyclable in theory, but primary production emits 16.5 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram, and recycled content is limited by alloy sorting challenges. You can't just melt down mixed aluminum scrap and get aerospace-grade alloy back out.
Timber!
Renewable and carbon negative if it's sustainably sourced. But it's susceptible to moisture, pests, and dimensional instability. It swells, it warps, it rots. You can't use it for outdoor storage or chemical storage, and even in dry indoor conditions, it won't survive 40 years of heavy handling the way HDPE will.
Yes?
Heavy, brittle, energy-intensive to transport. A glass container that can hold 300 kilograms doesn't exist at consumer scale, and if it did, the shipping cost would be absurd.
Bioplastics. PLA, PHA, that family?
This is the one people want to work, but they lack the durability for a 40-year service life. PLA is compostable under industrial conditions, but starts degrading with heat and moisture long before that. PHA is better but still doesn't match HDPE for impact resistance and chemical stability, and most bioplastics require industrial composting facilities that barely exist at scale. If a PLA Eurobox ends up in a landfill, it doesn't meaningfully degrade, and if it ends up in the ocean, it behaves a lot like conventional plastic.
So every alternative fails on at least one of the requirements Daniel listed. Lightweight, strong, weather-resistant, chemically resistant, stackable, affordable, capable of surviving years of abuse, HDPE hits every single one. The alternatives each miss two or three.
Which isn't to say we should use HDPE for everything. It's to say that for this specific application, industrial and long-life domestic storage, HDPE is the best available material. The environmental case against it collapses when you compare it to the alternatives on a per-decade basis rather than a per-unit basis.
The mistake is treating all plastic as equivalent. A disposable shopping bag and a 40-year Eurobox are both technically plastic, but they have about as much in common as a paper napkin and a hardwood floor.
That's the image, and the policy framework is already starting to reflect this. The EU directive targets single-use items, not durable goods. The next step is building the infrastructure that makes durable plastics truly circular.
Which brings us to the missing piece, repair and reuse infrastructure.
The reason consumer plastic bins fail is that they're not designed to be repaired. A hinge cracks, the lid goes in the trash, eventually the bin follows. A Eurobox has replaceable hinges, replaceable lids, replaceable corner protectors. But the parts supply chain, the repair centers, the take-back programs, none of that exists for consumers. If you crack a corner on your Eurobox, where do you even go? You call an industrial supplier and hope they'll sell you one replacement part without a business account.
We have repair ecosystems for cars and appliances. You can get a replacement door seal for a 20-year-old washing machine. But for a storage container that's designed to be repaired, the consumer-facing infrastructure simply doesn't exist.
And that's the real barrier to scaling consumer adoption. It's not the product. The product is proven. It's the surrounding system. If I could tell a customer, buy this Eurobox, and if anything ever breaks, we'll ship you the replacement part within 2 days, the value proposition changes completely. Suddenly, the $40 price tag includes a lifetime warranty that's actually meaningful.
That's the business opportunity Daniel circling, not just selling containers, building the repair ecosystem around them. The container as a service model bakes that in, because the company owns the containers and has every incentive to keep them repairable.
And if you're thinking even bigger, there's a standardization play here. What if consumer storage adopted the same standards as industrial logistics? Your moving boxes, your basement storage, your garage organization, all on the same pallet-based footprint, all interoperable, all repairable. Moving companies could offer standardized container rental instead of cardboard boxes. Self-storage facilities could integrate directly with the system. The whole chain becomes more efficient.
A moving company that shows up with a stack of Euroboxes instead of cardboard boxes and packing tape. You pack, you move, you return the empties. No waste, no tape, no collapsed boxes.
It exists in pockets. Some moving companies in Europe offer reusable plastic crate rental already, but it's fragmented, regional, not standardized. The opportunity is scaling that into a coherent system.
All of this points to the infrastructure gap. Without repair and reuse systems, even the best-designed plastic container is just a longer-lived piece of waste. With those systems, it's a durable asset in a circular economy.
That's where the policy question gets interesting. The EU directive drew a line around single-use items. The next logical step isn't banning durable plastics, it's requiring repairability and take-back programs for them. If you're going to produce an HDPE container that lasts 40 years, you should also be required to supply replacement parts for 40 years.
That would transform the economics overnight. If every manufacturer had to support their products with parts and repair, the cheap disposable bin model stops making sense. You design for repairability from the start, because you're on the hook either way.
The consumer benefits. Right now, planned obsolescence is priced into consumer storage. The manufacturer wants you to buy another bin in 5 years. A repairability mandate flips that. They want you to keep the bin forever and buy parts instead.
Let's pull this into something actionable. Daniel asked what the sales pitch would be, who would it appeal to, and what the end state looks like. We've covered the segments and the pitch. Let's talk about what someone listening could actually do.
Three things. First, if you're considering industrial plastic storage for your home or small business, evaluate it on a per-decade cost basis, not upfront cost. A Eurobox that costs $40 but lasts 40 years is cheaper than a $10 bin replaced every 5 years, and generates less waste. The math is straightforward once you shift the time frame.
Second, and this is the one that actually changes things, support or create repair infrastructure. If you buy industrial containers, find out whether the manufacturer sells replacement parts. If they don't, ask. Consumer demand for repairability is what drives design changes. A dozen people emailing a manufacturer asking for replacement lid hinges is more powerful than 100 people complaining on social media.
Third, for the business thought experiment, Daniel's playing with the opportunity isn't selling containers, it's selling storage as a service. A subscription model where customers pay monthly for a set of Euroboxes with free repair and replacement aligns incentives for durability and circularity. That's the model that could actually scale consumer adoption because it removes the upfront cost barrier and builds the repair ecosystem into the business.
The container as a service model also solves the plastic is bad marketing problem. You're not selling plastic, you're selling organized space, moving convenience, inventory management. The material is an implementation detail.
The environmental benefit is real, not greenwashed. A CHEP-style pallet pool for consumer storage would keep containers in circulation for decades, with repair rates in the single digits per cycle. The per-use carbon footprint drops to almost nothing over a long enough service life.
Which brings us to the question Daniel ended on. If we accept that some plastic is necessary, how do we decide which applications are essential? Is it purely a matter of material properties, or is there a moral dimension?
I think it's both. The material properties tell you where plastic is the best option. Applications requiring chemical resistance, impact toughness, lightweight, and long service life. Storage containers, medical devices, automotive components, construction materials. The moral dimension tells you where plastic convenience has externalized costs that someone else pays. Single-use packaging that ends up in rivers. Disposable items that become someone else's waste management problem.
The line isn't plastic versus no plastic. It's who bears the cost of this plastic and for how long.
A 40-year Eurobox concentrates its costs at the point of production and keeps them there. The carbon is emitted once, the material stays in use, and at end of life, the HDPE is recyclable. Not perfectly, not infinitely, but recyclable into new, durable goods. A single-use shopping bag disperses its costs across its entire brief existence and then offloads them onto ecosystems and municipalities for centuries.
Same material family. Radically different moral calculus.
The next decade is going to force this distinction into policy and consumer awareness. The EU has already started. Extended producer responsibility laws are spreading. The push will be towards standardized, repairable, circular plastic products, and away from disposable everything. The Eurobox is a template for what that looks like, but only if the infrastructure catches up.
The end state isn't a world without plastic. It's a world where plastic is used deliberately, for applications where it's the best material, in products designed to stay in circulation for decades. The disposable stuff gets replaced by alternatives that make sense for short-life applications. Paper, compostable materials, reusable systems. The durable stuff gets supported by repair infrastructure and take-back programs.
That's a more honest environmentalism than plastic bad. It acknowledges that every material has a footprint, every choice involves trade-offs, and the goal is to match the material to the use case in a way that minimizes harm over the full life cycle.
The question isn't plastic or no plastic. It's what do we want plastic to do, and how long do we want it to last?
The cutting room floor detail I keep coming back to is the Shiaichi prepare rate, 5% per cycle. That means out of 300 million pallets moving through the system, only 15 million need any repair per rotation. The other 285 million just keep going. That's the benchmark for what a well-designed circular system looks like, and has been operating quietly for decades while we argue about straws.
It makes you wonder what other infrastructure is hiding in plain sight, doing circularity right, while the public conversation fixates on the wrong targets.
The pallet under your delivery, the container on the ship, the crate in the warehouse, the unglamorous backbone of logistics figured out reuse decades ago. We just haven't bothered to extend the model to consumers.
Something to think about next time you're in a self-storage facility, surrounded by collapsing cardboard boxes and cracked plastic tubs. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's about to move apartments. They'll thank you.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.